I had an interesting interaction not all that long ago, and it kind of makes the point of what I want to talk about in the podcast tonight, and that is that I was walking out of a building, the hall that I teach from and also my office is in, and so I'm on my way out. I bump into a friend, a former student, who was coming back into the building to visit with someone. And, it was odd. And that's what basically he said was, you're leaving so soon, because usually I don't leave until, just later than usual closing time. I'm always around longer appointments and other things like that. And I was heading out probably at least a couple of hours earlier than I usually do, and I said, yeah, I just ran out of gas and I'm ready to I'm just going home. And he looked at me kind of odd and said, are you okay? And it took me off guard, actually. Because at some level, I sort of expected this person to know that, no, I wasn't okay at all. And it wasn't all that long after we came back from Lexington and the memorial service and spending time with my friend's family and all of that. And I hit a wall. I was able to rally enough to get to do the classes I was teaching. And once I hit that threshold, there really wasn't much left, really, for anything or anyone for that matter. And there's a lot of my job that is very people heavy, very people intense, if you will. And that's normal. That's been a part of my job for 15 years. And so it's not new at all. But I recognize that my ability to be present with people was very, very limited, and it would only be fair to them for me to head home and take care of myself, because I tend to talk a little bit about that. So I did, but then I said, well, no, I'm not all right. I still am involved. I'm feeling all of the things that are related to losing a really good friend. And then this look ran across his face like, oh, I just stepped in it. And the funny thing about it is that there was a subtle pressure. It was unintended, completely unintended. This happens probably on a daily basis for people that are in the midst of lament, in the midst of sorrow. The people will ask, and they will be insensitive to the state that they're in, even if they may know it. And then they ask the question, and then suddenly the person who is in this state, in the grieving state, if you will, feels guilty that they're not better yet. And that really was part of the dynamic that I felt during that time. And that's some of what I want to talk about tonight, because in a lot of ways, walking through sorrow, we're always trying to figure out if we're doing it quote unquote right. And that's a problem. That's a major problem. And that's what I want to try to explore here for a little bit of time. I'm not going to overstay my welcome, but but let me tell you a little bit of what you've just tuned into. If you're visiting for the first time, you're listening to the Unscripted podcast. It is subtitle is The Collected Wisdom of Life, Living, and Sorrow. And I am Dr. Ray Mitch, your host, and that's very much a part of what we're here about. I don't come to it with any particular script in mind or any particular topic matter to talk about. Sometimes I'm triggered, if you want to use that word, by a lecture that I've given, which today I did two different lectures today, all related to grief and grieving and death. And so that pretty much is what knocked this stone down the hill. for me to be talking about it tonight. So that's what we're about. It is part of what I am calling Outpost Media. We have another podcast in separate from Unscripted called the Outpost Podcast. And I talk about a variety of topics having to do with spiritual formation and psychology and life itself. So you can check that out when you can. Let me continue down this road for a few minutes, because we're always searching for reference points or points that tell us that we're on the right track. And while that is a very normal thing for us to do, when it comes to walking through the journey of grief, it is a remarkably individual thing. And I was playing a short video clip for my students today, and the guy that was on there said, you know, pretty much my anger is a lot like your anger, and my happiness is a lot like your happiness, but my grief is unique to me. My grief is nothing like yours. And there's a beauty to that, and then there's also a strangeness to it, or like I'm caught on a sea with no compass and no way to know where I'm going, and I'm in a fog, and I'm not sure what next steps I'm supposed to take. And even when I say that, it's supposed to take. In other words, there is a prescribed set of steps that I must engage in order to do this thing that they call grieving. And the worst part about it is it's unique to me. The best part about it is it's unique to me. And the problem is usually we don't give ourselves permission to be free in how we manage and experience our grief. We're always looking for a way to compare it to someone else, and that way we can know that we're doing it, quote unquote, right. And that is a poison pill when it comes to going through the grief process, because there is a subtle pressure, I think, ultimately in all of us, particularly with this disorienting kind of experience of losing somebody important in our lives, where we're not really sure what the next steps are. And when we do them, our first kind of first blush reaction is, I hope this is right, or I hope I'm doing the right thing that is the best. And rarely do we have anyone that can sit down with us and look us in the eye and say, this is completely normal. Let the process take care of itself. Engage it as you can and allow it just to proceed as it does. And so the thing that I think often comes up is we have this subtle pressure inside of us that is growing the longer we're in this state of sorrow. And quite honestly, it comes down to, I'm tired of being sad. I'm tired of the fatigue. I'm tired of the level of numbness that I'm feeling and how unnerving it is. And I can tell you from my own experience that if you were to go into and read some of my journal entries, there are a number of places where I simply say, I don't know what I'm feeling. I don't really think I don't feel anything. Now, I'm not the model or the paragon of virtue when it comes to identifying feelings. I've had a lot of practice at it because I sit with people all the time. But it's still there. It's still there. And it's the numbness. It really is the numbness. And there's a certain relief to that that I think oftentimes we experience. And we don't see it that way. I think sometimes what happens is that we've gotten this notion that denial is bad, and somehow I should always be kind of nose to the grindstone, always in it, always dealing with it, and then I can get it over with faster. And it really isn't how this journey looks at all. And like I said, the worst thing about it is unique to us. So we end up discovering it as we go rather than looking for somebody to tell me what the path is and I follow it. And that's the danger of a lot of models that you hear today around grief, is that they're comforting because they adjust our expectations about what's to come next. The problem is they're also very dangerous because we tend to shoehorn our experiences into the model rather than allowing our experiences to enlighten the model for us. Because we don't believe that what we're doing is, or how we're doing it, is the right way. And that's why we're looking for a right. And ultimately, it robs us of the freedom to simply be where we're at and just being there with it. And one of the things that I have said to people before, particularly with walking through grief, is it's a lot like a song. And I'll date myself because at one point in time, I listened a lot to John Denver, which some people may be turning their noses up immediately or throwing me out entirely because I'm not credible. I listened to somebody like John Denver. Get over yourself. So what this is about here is one of the songs he had was Some Days Are Diamonds and Some Days Are Stones. And that is very much the journey through grief that happens. Some days we can have a really good day, not feel like we're walking around with a weighted blanket on us. And then other days we just want to sit and let the weighted blanket just push down on us and curl up and watch a movie or do whatever we do, you know, read or for distraction or scroll through Instagram or watch YouTube videos ad nauseum, whatever it might be. It very much is a part of the landscape, I think, of what we do. And so there's one aspect or feature in grief that I don't think we count on bumping into, and that is we want to move forward, we want to feel better. But that feeling better often triggers a sense of guilt because I'm leaving someone behind. And that's hard. That really is very, very hard. I think the aspect of, and I literally had somebody saying this to me not more than a week ago, is that if I recover from my grief, it is another loss. It's one thing for the person to die. It's another for me to move on into my life, into my future, all of those sorts of things, and I lose that person again. And that's the push and the pull, I think, of the grief journey, is we feel bad, and it feels bad to go through what we do and experience what we do, and we're looking for something to anchor ourselves to in order to know that maybe I can shorten this thing called grief. And I, you know, I have talked to people for 40 years, and this issue, this grief and loss issue, or sorrow and lament, has bubbled to the surface in virtually every one of my clients. I have said this to people before. I said this to students even gathered today, is that don't fool yourself into thinking that you won't need to know anything about grief and grieving and loss, because everyone that comes into your office is experiencing some kind of loss. Everybody does. It can be a loss of self-image. It can be a loss of a job. It can be a loss of a spouse through death. It can be the loss of a family member through estranged relationships. It can be any number of things like that. And it's worth our while to understand that the first response to our grief is grace, not more demands. And I'll let that sink in. Our first response to our grief needs to be grace, not more demands to move faster and higher and longer and deeper and any of the other extensive adjectives we can come up with to say this is not good enough. Because grace, the thing about grace, and again, this is one of these topics I talk a lot about, and for a lot of people, we live in a very graceless culture. It's I wouldn't say it's dog eat dog, but what you reap is what you're gonna, or what you sow is what you're gonna reap, and it's a harsh reality out there. And grace actually gives us a space to grow. It's not meant to give us a pass to grow. It gives us a space to grow, and that is true in our grieving process, is meeting ourselves with gentleness and with grace and a willingness to kind of sit with ourselves in it and be able to experience what it is, whatever it is we're experiencing. Now, it needs to be said that our approach to handling emotions and emotion management, if you will, and regulation would be another word that we use, at least in psychology, is already been established before we get into the grief process. We already have an established approach to handling emotions, and that may be suppression, just pushing it down, getting on with life, keep moving, and don't let, quote unquote, don't let it get you down, okay? Or we can lean into it so far that we drown in it and we lose all of our bearings and we get very, very disoriented. And then the other alternatives is somewhere between those two poles. And the reality is how do I sit with the emotions that I have without condemning them, without saying I should be better, this should be over by now, whatever that is. I don't care how short it is. I've had people say that in a month. It's like, I should be over this by now. It's been a month. This is more than enough time to get over the grief that I've had with somebody that I have spent a good portion of my life with. It makes no sense. It makes no sense at all. And yet, the desire for it to be over isn't related to the person. It's related to my discomfort around what it is I'm experiencing and what it is I'm feeling because I've had no practice in dealing with those things. And so there is this pressure that we feel internally, and then there's also this element of guilt about going on because we're leaving behind that. And so the challenge within the first kind of stages of this is, like I said before, is denial. And denial isn't always bad. Actually, to some degree, denial in the early stages of grief allows me some room to breathe emotionally. And I can take a break from what it is that I'm in. Now, that doesn't mean that I forget the fact of what happened. But remember that denial isn't just about facts. It's about meaning and about significance and about future impacts and all of those things. And that's very much a part of this landscape of walking the journey through sorrow. Now, what does this have to do with the larger picture of life and living? Well, let me go back to what I was saying just a minute ago, because sorrow and loss and grief are part of our everyday lives, and we really, really don't like that, quite honestly. We really don't like it because we think that if I allow it to exist, I will always be depressed. I'll always feel bad. It will never get better. And the reality is the minute I make those assertions, I am now prohibiting myself from having any of those emotions at all. The thing to keep in mind is that when you start shutting down the circuit breakers on sadness, you will have a direct impact on the circuit breakers. These are all figurative, of course, on all the circuit breakers having to do with all the positive emotions, happiness, excitement, joy, all of those are muted Because our lives were meant to have a contrast in them. For every mountain, there is a valley. For every sadness, there is a joy. For every sorrow, there is a joy and happiness. And happiness gains its significance and understanding and depth from sorrow because we've experienced it. And that's true for any of the other contrasts in our lives, whether that's disappointment. And disappointment is terrible. It feels awful to go through it. But then the elation of accomplishment has even greater significance because I've experienced disappointment. And that is an important thing to arm ourselves with, even just generally in life itself. Because sorrow is not the problem. Feeling bad is not the problem. It is our expectations of life that is the problem. If we have expectations from life that is only happiness and above, that's all there is. I don't want to talk about, think about, or any experience anything to do with sadness or bad feelings or anything like that, then there are two things that come from that. One is I'm never practiced, and sooner or later it will hit me, and I won't have any idea what to do. Secondly, I build no sense of resilience around the emotions that humans generally, normally have. See, the thing to keep in mind is that grief and grieving is a uniquely, profoundly human experience. Now, we find correlates in the animal kingdom. There are some species in the animal kingdom that are monogamous, and they're monogamous for life. And so when their mate is killed or something happens, they usually exhibit signs of what we call pining. That's where we get the word pining away, right? And so Canadian geese is a good example. They're monogamous for life. And if their mate is killed or hit by a car or whatever, it's not uncommon to see them standing at the side of the road, seemingly watching over that, over their mate, because they're gone. They don't think in those terms because they're geese. But at the same time, you see very similar behaviors as we have, is that we can drop into the sorrow of the loss and what we've experienced around it and everything like that. And we kind of go into this suspended animation in our emotions and in our decision-making, our concentration lags behind, we get distracted, absent-minded. All of those things are very much a part of the beginning stages, if you will, of grief. Sometimes they persist all the way through, and that is very, very normal. It's very, very frustrating, I will grant you. It is very frustrating, but at the same time, it is very normal. It's very much of the human experience in experiencing grief. And so there's so much to look at and understand. And the thing that I would have you take away if you're listening to this, and the punchline, if you will, is how can we learn how to exercise grace toward ourselves, not to give us a pass from the hard stuff of life, but to give us the space to grow because of them and to grow even into them. And it's not going to happen all at once. The goodbye that maybe was said at the start of the grieving process may have to be said again because we change. I think I mentioned this in the last episode about being on a river called life, and I step off of the river, and the river keeps flowing along, and I can't get to the point that I was at when I stepped out of it. And yet when I step back into it, I'm threatened with almost feeling drowning because of all the demands and everything else that really hasn't stopped while I was away. And that's the tyranny, if you will, of everyday life that demands from us a response of some sort, particularly when we're in a role of responsibility toward other people and other things like that. And so you really don't have a forum in which to talk to other people that are would step out of the river with you and to say, this is what I'm feeling, this is how I'm experiencing it, and we don't try to fix one another or tell each other how it should be. We just listen to the story that it is as it is at that time, because it will change. It will change every time, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. I can have a whole string of good days and then tank completely from something that seems relatively minor. And my capacity, internal emotional capacity, is low anyway as a result of the grief that I feel. And then it doesn't take much to empty it. And then I don't have much left in the tank, if you will, to do a lot of other things. And being more demanding, being more shoulding all over ourselves, and I'll enunciate that very carefully, doing all this, what I should do, how I should do, how I should think, what I could have done, what I should have done, all of those take us back into a place that we don't necessarily have to visit. We can simply, we don't have to live, let me put it that way. We can visit, but we don't have to live there. And so the same thing is true in walking through our lives and the sorrow we experience. It is not a death knell for our future. The only thing that makes it a death knell for our future, in other words, kind of shutting it down and getting stuck here, is refusing to do anything with it. And that always is the case, is people that refuse to adapt, refuse to learn new skills, which is way later down the road. It's not right now if it's a new grief. But learning new skills and adapting to the world without the person in it, and allowing ourselves to feel the absence and to feel the separation factor in it, or the emptiness that it feels like, or any number of things. And as the year goes on, we become more aware of the role that the person played and the things that we just counted on being there, and now they're not there anymore. And that's normal. It is very normal. As a matter of fact, it almost seems like a mini episode of grief again to be reminded of their absence around a particular activity or something like that. And it could be a birthday, it could be, you know, a random text message that comes in, or anything like that, that we didn't even really realize that we were getting accustomed to it, but we were getting accustomed to it, and it was very much a part of that. Now, there's a couple other things I want to mention while I'm on it, and why this is so important to devote my time to talking it through. And one of the most basic things about it is that we don't accept that sorrow and death is a reality in our lives. We live in a culture that worships youth, that worships a life that looks like an Instagram feed or a Facebook feed. It does not give room for the reality, the harsh realities of living and all that it means. Imagine for a moment what it would be like if we actually put up on Facebook or Instagram how our lives actually went that day with our commentary to it. A lot of people would say that is the most depressing place on earth. And that's exactly why we tend to gloss over or put a veneer over the hard parts of our lives. And what that essentially does is it hampers us from walking through it in any kind of way that's healthy, or a recognition of what's going on there. So we have a tendency to not accept death as a reality. Now, that doesn't mean we don't accept it as a fact, but as a reality means the impact it has on us, and the impact it has on our future and the important people in our lives. The other one I'll mention that I've been talking about all day today, so I'll just finish the day talking about it, is that we see death as an interruption to our lives instead of being continuous with our lives. It's a significant part of our lives that there is a a punctuation point at the end of our lives. And we can't necessarily, we can't change that punctuation point. And so we see death as an enemy to continuing life as if we are going to live life forever. And there was a very much of a telltale kind of quote from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was is kind of the, for a lot of people, is the gold standard, if you will, around grieving and stages and all that. And I don't think she should be, really. I think that, but she makes the comment that oftentimes we live life as if we will never die, and therefore we never do the things that are the most important to us because we don't see it that way. And so it's a significant part, I think, of the process of understanding that we see death as an enemy rather than death as being a part of our lives and seeing it that way. And then one other one that I'll mention, which I experienced personally as a kid, is we don't really use have anyone, we don't really use, we don't usually have anyone in our lives that teaches us how to grieve. We just think that it happens naturally. And quite honestly, it doesn't. I mean, once we know that we're in it, we can fight it and try to make it into something that it isn't. But nobody ever talks to us. We don't sit down and have, you know, a drink with a friend or dinner with somebody and say, so how's your grieving going? Or what kind of, how are you handling the loss? Now, amongst people that share that loss, they might. But we don't talk about that kind of stuff with anyone else. And therefore, we're missing all kinds of important conversations around the most important things. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross made the comment, and I just showed the video clip to my students today. And she said the most honest people that she has ever met are dying children, psychotics that are creating their own reality and they'll just tell you what it is, and dying adults. And she said the dying children are actually more honest than the dying adults are. But those are the people that talk about the important stuff because they see the end of the runway. And that's usually when we have those conversations, unfortunately, right? We don't have ongoing conversations about those things because we keep kind of pushing the runway out, hoping that it may be it may continue. And then something interferes, something happens. Even old age, just because somebody's old doesn't mean that we still don't feel somewhat surprised by what has happened. And a lot of times you will have people say, this just happened so suddenly. And the person is getting on in years. They're really long in the tooth. So it's a significant part, I think, of the conversation that we have to have. And I think it's one that I'm just, in a sense, with this podcast, I'm trying to initiate the conversation and get it going and talking and prompting people to talk about the really important stuff before it gets to the point where we're running out of time to talk about the really important stuff. So that's it for tonight. Thanks so much for joining me. You've been listening to Unscripted, the podcast. And if you're interested in finding out more about me and about the ministry of Stained Glass International, which the Unscripted is a part of, you can go to our website at sgi-net.org see all the resources that are there. You can purchase one or both of my books about grief that I wrote. One I wrote many years ago, 30 years to be exact. And the newest one just came out in January. It's called The Seasons of Our Grief. And you I would invite you to take a look at it and pick it up. Maybe look at it in Kindle and say, yeah, I think this is worth my while to have a hard copy. That's what I do. And be able to do that. So this is a larger ministry that Unscripted is a part of. This is really a podcast that is born out of need, out of desire to articulate things that most of the time people don't spend much time talking about. And that's what I really want to, like I said, kind of initiate the conversation around by doing this thing. So if you feel so inclined and would like to support the mission and vision of SGI and a podcast like this, and you would like to support us financially, we would be ever so grateful. You can do that using the donate button on the website, or you can also send it to us physically at P.O. Box 322, East Glen, Colorado, 80614, if you're so interested. We would be ever so appreciative. We are having and putting on retreats, and my hope certainly would be to eventually develop groups around grief that allows us to have these conversations on a more regular basis. So that's it for tonight. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next time, love ya. Later. Bye.